Good morning. You're tuned to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. I'm Joe Clement, your host for today's Old Mole Variety Hour. Tammy Dean is our engineer. As moles, we agitate for revolution from below. We educate about the power the masses have to change the world and inoculate against the fear that there is no alternative or that we don't deserve a classless, moneyless society free of domination and exploitation. We feature interviews with activists and scholars, commentary and analysis from a radical intersectional socialist feminist point of view, and review books, film, music, and other art with that political lens. The first half of today's show revolves around fighting for free mass transit for all. The Well-Read Red looks at getting rid of fares on TriMet and Opal's Up With Riders campaign. And then I talk with Anthemis of the Pacific Northwest Youth Liberation Front about an upcoming rally to eliminate fares on TriMet and for fare enforcement justice. Movie Moles Denise Morris and Naomi Nori review the dark comedy Jojo Rabbit. Set during World War II in Germany, the film focuses on a member of the Hitler Youth who discovers his mother is hiding a Jewish girl in their attic, as well as his struggle with his beliefs and his imaginary friend Adolf Hitler. To round out the show, our Left in the Law duo Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker report both good news and bad news on the legal front. As Trump judges and the Federalist Society celebrate 150 new federal appointments, progressive prosecutors, very progressive prosecutors, are getting elected all across the country. You can listen to and share past shows and segments of The Old Mole by going to kboo.fm/oldmole. Today's show will be posted in a day or two. You can like and follow us on Facebook and Twitter to get updates about upcoming shows. You can write the moles at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com with your comments, questions, suggestions, and leads, or if you'd like to get involved with the show. And now, to start off the show, here's our Well-Read Red. The Well-Read Red has been thinking and reading about mass transit lately. The ongoing revolt in Chile was notably catalyzed by a campaign led by high schoolers in the capital city of Santiago to jump turnstiles and otherwise evade fares after the government proposed raising already high fares by 4%. It's resulted in a reversal of the fare hike, the resignation of several high-ranking members of the Chilean government, and the promise of education, healthcare, and pension reforms by President Sebastián Piñera. From San Francisco to New York, transit systems are over-policing. And in New York in particular, the Metropolitan Transportation Authority is under criticism for spending almost as much money on fare enforcement and as it says that it's losing to fare evasion. Over the weekend, police arrested several protesters, and ABC News there reports...
The activist group Decolonize the Space is calling for the removal of the NYPD from the subways and for the funds to be used for fixing the MTA and making it free. There are reports of several arrests at protests tonight.
In the Portland area, TriMet has come under deserved criticism for its increasing spending on fare enforcement, budgeting $11 million on a jail for transit-related offenses, including but not limited to fare evasion. TriMet has added several officers to check TriMet passenger fares, while a Multnomah County judge earlier this year has ruled that the suspicionless search for rider transfers is unconstitutional per the Oregon Constitution, a ruling which TriMet has disputed. To add insult to injury, TriMet embarked on a smarmy ad campaign this last month to chastise fare evasion by comparing fare evaders to, quote, the guy who doesn't chip in for drinks, end quote, which critics have pointed out conflates a public good with a luxury. TriMet calls the campaign, which it pulled after a month of public outcry, a friendly reminder, but the public response suggests that it's completely out of touch with the economic realities facing transit users. Then, recently, the Willamette Week reported on how transit cops cited a homeless street roots vendor $175 for not properly tapping his hop card, despite it being a monthly pass. These and other moves by TriMet have prompted some to renew the argument that we should do away with fares altogether. Tonight on Labor Radio, from 6 to 6:30 p.m., two stalwart advocates of mass transit users will dig deeper into these issues and how we can demilitarize our transit system, in part by doing away with fares altogether. Gabriela Saldana Lopez is an organizer with Opal Environmental Justice Oregon. She's born and raised in Portland, the daughter of Mexican immigrants. She's working on Opal's Up With Riders campaign and the BRU, the Bus Riders Union. Andrew Riley is a former union representative for the Bus Drivers Union, Amalgamated Transit Union 757. He wrote a lengthy but entirely accessible essay on the feasibility and desirability of TriMet abolishing fares. I'd like to read from and mostly summarize his best main points from that essay, but first we're going to hear from Opal's Up With Riders campaign in this official ad.
Portland is falling behind on public transit. Ridership is going down year after year, and decision makers will speed up the trend with fare hikes. We foresee a great transition of the transportation sector within our own lifetimes, and it would reshape our entire community mood. For this transition to advance justice, the plan must address climate change, pollution, exclusion, and lack of service. And it must come from the people who face the worst injustices in our current transportation system.
We, our bus riders unite, Portland's union of transit-dependent people.
We are the Youth Environmental Justice Alliance, a youth of color-led organizing space.
We are Opal Environmental Justice Oregon, organizers building power for environmental justice and civil rights in our communities.
We are low-income people, we are people of color.
Seniors and the disabled.
We are youth and residents of underserved communities.
We are immigrants, refugees, and people who face the worst impacts of climate change.
Our communities are being targeted and profiled by police. People don't feel safe on public transit.
Single occupancy cars lead to dirty air and unsafe streets.
Congestion is slowing down our buses and trains.
TriMet is planning fare hikes which will reduce ridership.
We have a plan to make the system work for us.
We want rider advocates and community-centered solutions for safety.
We demand robust improvements to public transportation to support safe and healthy communities.
We need dedicated bus lanes and transit signal priority.
We must improve accessibility and move toward making our transit system fareless. Let's start with Youth Pass.
Up With Riders is our campaign to increase ridership by stopping fare hikes and expanding safe, decriminalized, and fareless transit service. We believe transit is a fundamental human right that should never be militarized, enclosed, privatized, or for-profit driven. We demand a system that is robust, equitable, and accessible. Public transportation is a common good which excludes no person, is controlled democratically by the people who rely most upon it, and serves everyone to the maximum extent possible. We reject false solutions which increases inequity and worsens outcomes. Only by reducing the use of personal vehicles can we create healthy, resilient communities with safe streets, clean air, and thriving commerce.
I'm Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. That was an official campaign ad from Opal's Up With Riders campaign. You can hear an Opal organizer, Gabriela Saldana Lopez, talk about that campaign tonight on Labor Radio from 6 to 6:30. Andrew Riley, who will also appear on Labor Radio, wrote an essay earlier this year titled The Case for a Fareless TriMet. He points out that first things first, TriMet would not be the first transit agency in the world to go fare-free, and it wouldn't even be the first in Oregon. Both Corvallis City Transit and Wilsonville's South Metro Area Rapid Transit Systems are fare-free. Wilsonville's SMART system is partially fare-free. Most of its routes are fare-free, except for the express routes between Salem and Portland, which charge between $1.50 and $3 a ride. It's paid for through a 0.5% payroll tax on employers, as well as outside grant funding. The city of Corvallis operates a system called CTS, the Corvallis City Transit, which is operated by an outside contractor but funded by the city. In 2011, CTS abolished fares after passing a transit operation fee, a monthly fee charged to utility customers who live within the city. As of January 2019, the fee works out to be about $3.16 per month for folks who live in a single-family home and $2.18 per month for folks in apartments. It's also charged to commercial and industrial operators based on their type of business. Everyone sees their monthly charge on their water bill. And then he also notes that the capital of Estonia, Tallinn, partially abolished fares on their transit system after a referendum supported by 75% of voters in 2013. The system is free for residents, but costs tourists money. He recognizes that critics might say that these regions serve many fewer people than Portland. He says that providing fare-free transit in Portland would cost more in raw dollars than in either of these examples. But the reality is, the question is not whether the funding sources exist to pay for this. They do. After all, TriMet was easily able to find $11 million to build a new transit jail, and they've no shortage of money for their pet projects like the West Boondoggle. The question is, do we have the political will to make it happen? He points out that in TriMet's 2020 adopted budget, the agency assumes that 16.1% of their revenue will be passenger revenue, which is a wonky way of saying fares. 60.1% of their funding comes from payroll taxes, and 19.6% comes from state and federal grants. He says that in dollar amounts, we have to be able to raise $110 million to replace fares entirely. To address this, he considers other funding sources. The Oregon Revised Statute, Chapter 267, governs mass transit districts, of which there are two in Oregon: TriMet, Lane Transit District, and technically the Kaiser-Salem Chariot System. This part of Oregon law empowers these transit districts to tax and otherwise extract fees on a mass basis outside the collection of fares. So there are different mechanisms for getting the money. There's also the question of how we spend the money. He argues that collecting fares itself is a costly endeavor. You have to pay for fare enforcement, you have to pay for ticket machines and their materials, and apparently you have to pay for an $11 million jail. You should read it for all the details and or listen to tonight's Labor Radio, but he says, quote, "My proposal here is simple. We should fund a fare-free TriMet primarily through a graduated personal business income tax, an increase in the employer payroll tax, which already funds operations, a reduction in the costs of administering a fare system, and a reduction of capital expenses to operations." End quote. Intuitively, he says, this will improve ridership. It improved ridership in Corvallis by 37.9% in the first year the system went free. In the capital city of Estonia, ridership went up 14% within the first 9 months. And when Merced, California experimented with a short-term fare period, ridership went up nearly 27%. And as a local example, he points out that when TriMet implemented Fareless Square in 1975, trips within that area increased 811% over the next 3 years. He says that according to the Oregon Department of Transportation, of all agencies, a 1% decrease in fares is expected to yield a 0.4% increase in ridership. You'd expect then that a 100% decrease in fares would yield a 40% increase in ridership, which closely matches the Corvallis example. As the ad we just heard pointed out, TriMet's ridership is going down, and so this would be a great way to increase it. Increasing ridership is going to be the only way that we decrease cars on the road and congestion and the attendant problems it causes for our commutes, as well as the environmental crisis. Eliminating fares will also just speed up service. When you aren't having to collect fares, you don't have to wait as long, and you don't have to actually police the actions of every rider as they get on and off the bus. You don't even have to have riders get on the bus at the front, because if you're not observing whether they pay fares, it doesn't matter if they get on at the back of the bus. And we aren't even going into the added quality of service that we would experience if we didn't have cops trying to shake us down and harass us on our buses and trains. Tune in tonight, Labor Radio, 6 to 6:30 p.m. to hear Gabriela Saldana Lopez and Andrew Riley talk about the Up With Riders campaign and how we can build a just and equitable and fairless transit system for Portlanders and beyond. You can also churn out to the next TriMet board meeting, which is going to be December 11th, at 8:30 in the morning, early, I know, but well worth it, at the World Trade Center building downtown at 121 Southwest Salmon. Opal and other organizations are going to be showing up, and you can too, to speak out against the proposed hikes to fares TriMet is making for the next budget year, and to demand a fare moratorium. We'll have more about it on the Old Mole in the next week or two, but put it on your calendar. December 11th, 8:30 in the morning, the World Trade Center building in downtown Portland, 121 Southwest Salmon. For the Old Mole Variety Hour, I'm Joe Clement with the Well Read Red. You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm your host today, Joe Clement. Well, our well-read read and done by yours truly, was about abolishing fares and otherwise seeking justice in our mass transit systems. And in the pursuit of that, I have brought on a member of the Pacific Northwest Youth Liberation Front to talk about a rally that they are organizing on November 29th for fare enforcement justice and no fares. Welcome to KBOO, Anthemis.
Hello there.
So, you know, we heard the Well Read Red, which kind of laid out a lot of the broad particulars of what the stakes are with mass transit today. Mm-hmm. Could you tell us about the rally, when and where it is, and the specific demands you're going to be raising?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're having the rally at Pioneer Courthouse Square on November 29th, Black Friday, at 12 p.m. The specific demands we're having are, one, ending any and all contracts with G4S, a security company that has a multi-million dollar contract with ICE, despite TriMet's constant claims that it doesn't work with ICE, it still supports this company. Besides that, also the abolition of any and all fares and continued service and even upgraded service to previously disenfranchised neighborhoods like Black, Brown, working class neighborhoods that historically haven't had access to nearly as much public transit as other more white, more rich neighborhoods.
And isn't one of the demands kind of following on the abolition of fares, the reassignment of those people whose job it is to collect and enforce them?
Yeah, absolutely. We aren't here to take anyone's jobs. We're not here to get anyone fired over this. These people just are trying to get a job and happen to pick a bad one.
Right.
So we don't want to force them into poverty. We want them reallocated to other in-need jobs that TriMet has, like even bus drivers. I know they're constantly hiring.
Right. So the Pacific Northwest Youth Liberation Front is organizing this. How did this become a priority for your organization?
So we are an anti-fascist group founded around the axis of liberation of youth. We want young people to not be forced into poverty, forced into oppression. And specifically, the issue of mass transit came up multiple times when people would show up hours and hours late to our meetings or just wouldn't be able to make it at all because they were a couple of blocks away and couldn't afford bus fare. So really, it came up for us because this is a big issue for us, for all kinds of youth in Portland, even with like student passes and youth passes. A lot of us aren't in school. A lot of us can't afford a youth pass. So it's really, this is a direct issue that youth in Portland schools, in Beaverton, and all the surrounding Portland metro area are facing. And it came up for us because we want to stand up and say something about it. And more fare enforcement isn't going to help us with that.
Yeah, I remember that under Charlie Hale's administration, mayor of Portland, a few years ago, they changed the way the city subsidized the youth passes. What's the status on that program? Because I know in the Up With Riders campaign, they talk about reinstating that.
Yeah, so OPAL specifically, the, can't remember the acronym right now, but OPAL has been working to reinstate and even upgrade youth passes for years and years. I can't remember exactly how long the campaign has been going on, but they've really been hammering it out. And they specifically, I think, want to raise the age of youth passage to 18, but I am not entirely updated on that project.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that TriMet contracts with G4S, which is also known for receiving like training and like brutal tactics from the Israeli defense forces. How is fair enforcement part of or reflecting militarization in society more broadly, do you think?
Right. So G4S is the company that is staffed in most of the private prisons around America. They are basically a private militia with multiple, like numerous abuses of power that have been documented. They've been forcing people down under their boot for years and years, and TriMet and other public mass transit systems continue to use them. And this is really like a pretty direct reflection of how America is a little under the boot here. We're all being subjugated, being pushed down with police brutality, state repression, all kinds of horrible, horrible practices. And this is just a microcosm of the greater world where that's happening en masse to millions and millions of people.
Mm-hmm. How would you say that mass transit is, you know, beyond the question of militarization, just a social and ecological imperative, and why we need to extend it?
So mass transit gets riders off the road. It gets drivers into a bus instead of their own personal one-person car. So even like companies like Uber, Lyft, all kinds of like rideshare things, well, a great service if you need a ride sometimes don't help with that. So things like public mass transit get thousands and thousands of people off the street into one vehicle that will that really brings down the amount of pollution being put into the air. That was the justification, or that was the reasoning behind putting up the free fare square downtown, because they really pushed the green angle, which is a great idea. The entire point of mass transit, besides getting people around, is it gets riders off the road. It decreases congestion. It moves. It reduces like the safety hazard to pedestrians by bringing less cars on the road. So it's really like a social imperative that we continue to have this service, and bumping up fare is just gonna kill it.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Youth Liberation Front has said that it uses the St. Paul's principles, which include respecting a diversity of tactics. When it comes to fair enforcement justice, what's the place of policy and legislation? What's the place of direct action and solidarity?
So groups like OPAL have been doing like legislation and even like small protests or even pretty large protests for a while in Portland specifically, but there's been a real lack of direct action, of civil disobedience, of things that could be perceived as like powerful against transit specifically, against TriMet specifically. So we are encouraging people to engage with a diversity of tactics. If you think you can organize something that'll help encourage people to use transit in a safe way that will push this fair enforcement injustice back, that's absolutely something we're encouraging. And we're also encouraging people to text OPAL's hotline, which they set up with the Up With Riders campaign, for updates on their events specifically, because they really are holding it down, and we are just here to help and here to push even further, push even harder behind them.
Yeah, I look to what's going on in New York with the protests that we reported on happening over the weekend in response to a lot of the same stuff that we're talking about today here in Portland. Chile, as we mentioned earlier, was itself triggered by a mass fare evasion campaign that was led by high schoolers. They refer to them as secondary school students, but they're high schoolers basically. And so I'm wondering, you know, whether these are showing us the way in terms of like a new direction or a new line of attack with the problem.
Yeah, absolutely. With the New York fare strikes, Crime Think, a big umbrella group that puts out a lot of media, has just recently called for a nationwide fare strike on the 29th, which coincides with both Portland's our Pacific Northwest rally in the Pioneer Square, and also coincides with an action in Seattle by our sister group, the Seattle YLF. So, like, there's a lot of momentum right now. There's a lot of new tactics being tried, and it's really encouraging and really uplifting to see so many people rallying behind it.
All right, to just wrap things up, could you repeat the info about the rally and how folks can find out more about it or the Youth Liberation Front?
Yeah, absolutely. You can find out more info about the Youth Liberation Front on any social media at PNWYLF. On Facebook, it's Pacific Northwest YLF, the whole thing. And you can meet us at the rally at Pioneer Square at noon on Black Friday. There's also a small anti-Black Friday action going on a little beforehand that we aren't putting on, but a lot of us will probably still be around there then.
All right. Thank you for coming on and talking about this important issue and how we're taking action on it in Portland, Anthemus.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
I'm Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
The wheels on the bus go round and round, round and round. Round and round, the wheels on the bus go round and round, all through the town. The people on the bus should ride for free, ride for free, ride for free. The people on the bus should ride for free to combat climate change. Cops on the bus make us all unsafe, all unsafe. The cops on the bus make us all unsafe, all around the town. The cars on the road will go away, go away, go away. The cars on the road will go away if mass transit.
You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Joe Clement. That was a little parody to the classic children's song that goes with the theme of our previous conversation. Up next, we're going to turn to the Movie Moles, Denise Morris and guest reviewer Naomi Nori. They're going to be reviewing the new dark comedy, Jojo Rabbit.
Jojo Rabbit is a 2019 American film written and directed by Taika Waititi with Roman Griffin Davis as the title character, 10-year-old Johannes Jojo Betzler, an emerging Hitler youth. Set in the last year of the Second World War, Jojo struggles to find his place as his enthusiasm for the nationalist cause is out of sync with his taste for doing actual violence. To boost his confidence and combat his isolation and loneliness, Jojo invents a friendship with an imaginary, bungling, and insecure Hitler, played by director Waititi. Scarlett Johansson plays Jojo's mother, a member of the resistance, hiding Elsa, a young Jewish teenager, in the attic of their home. Elsa, played by Thomasine McKenzie, becomes Jojo's confidant as he seeks to understand and document Jewish traits through his skewed lens. Jojo Rabbit was released this past October 18th, 2019, and has been damned and praised in the press, many of the reviews coming out before the film's release. Now, a month later, cooler heads seem to have prevailed, and the conversation around the film has become much more insightful. As one reviewer writes, Taika Waititi is, quote, a filmmaker of Jewish and Maori descent, so he knows a thing or two about white supremacy. He certainly knows how to jab at its vulnerabilities. The hallmark of Kiwi comedy is deflation of grandeur. Naomi Kanori, welcome to KBOO. Thanks for joining me for this review.
Thank you, Denise. It's really, really nice to be here.
Jojo Rabbit has been marketed as this anti-hate satire, and that seems typical of movie studios marketing, where they sort of actually try to cover up what the film's really about or details about the film that might keep people from actually wanting to come out and see it. We feel like there's certainly a lot more going on in this film than just love prevails over hate. We'll try to unpack a lot of that and hopefully raise some questions. And you have a lot of thoughts about the way that this film is centered on children and the role of children mm-hmm. in the film, but also in war.
Well, it seems to me that one of the most remarkable characteristics of the film is that there are two young people who are ostensibly on two different sides of a situation. One is a young Jewish woman, Elsa, who lives in the attic of the house that is Jojo's home, unbeknownst to him, and he discovers her eventually. In their relationship, we see childhood being defined by the violence of adults, by a situation of war. And even in our own minds, we're looking for innocent and guilty parties. We're trying to reconcile the space where one or the other of them might be in the right or the wrong. This is a movie about how we see children in conflict, in terms of who's redeemable, who's irredeemable, what is a victim, who is not entitled to victim status. And so those are questions that occur to me in the viewing of the film and in considering the film.
And we talked a little bit about how the film mirrors the conditions that we live in. And just thinking mm-hmm. about children and thinking about bullying, mm-hmm. It's well established even through the comedy of the early part of the film that Jojo is on the downside of power mm-hmm. and he gets his name as a result of his inability to actually do violence to an extremely vulnerable being, a rabbit. Mm-hmm. And the taunting and the anger and hostility of the other youth in the camp is evident. That really stood out for me. This is relevant and timely, not just because we're dealing with white supremacy, the rise of fascism around the world, right-wing governments, we could go on, mm-hmm. but because kids are experiencing violence in their day-to-day lives on a regular basis. It includes what happens to them in schools by their peers.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems to me that that's part and parcel of the rise and the expansion of white supremacy. The continuing story of fascism is that we are now living in a time in which children's developmental experience is earmarked by isolation, by diminished self-esteem, loneliness, interfamilial violence, systemic violence within institutions, schools, through social services, etc. And we can't expect that these things don't nourish that situation. This is the cost of being included. The cost of inclusion is a hazing for many children. And I would say that is a foundational aspect of white supremacy.
That indoctrination, mm-hmm. yeah. Mm-hmm. And we could also say that indoctrination doesn't just happen around white supremacy. It happens, let's say, in our own country where we believe the story or the narrative of U.S. exceptionalism, the mm-hmm. idea that mm-hmm. we do no wrong around the world. What we do is for everyone's own good, mm-hmm. to use the language a parent might use with their child.
So often children are really deeply hip to what's not good, and they will work to give it a good face. They will often mm-hmm. create an ally in the process of trying to have some sense of self-preservation with that which they innately know is wrong, is violent or damaging. So in the film, I'm thinking about that too, mm-hmm. you know, because he can't quite cut the mustard, right?
Yeah, we see him hesitate in many scenes that can be both funny and also horrifying. For example, the book burning where mm-hmm. he hesitates to actually throw the book. And mm-hmm. it seems like he is drawn to participate through that sense of belonging and that need of belonging. There's an expression of joy that these kids are having when they're burning these books. I mean, he has a remarkable ability to expose the horror with that bit of humor and also through this lens of innocence. This is not the first that he's used children mm-hmm. as a vehicle to explore something in his films. One thing that marks Jojo's existence is his isolation. He lives with his mom. Father is away. He understands his father to be at war, but also hears that his father is a coward. He spends most of his time either in this hostile environment with the Hitler Youth or with his mother in their home. So the point at which Jojo discovers that there is someone living upstairs in the attic, we have a good solid sense of his isolation and his loneliness.
As well, we have that sense in his imagined friend who takes the shape of Adolf Hitler.
Right, who is kind of bungling and has insecurities, also blows up.
Right, he manages to be a reflection of the things that it seems that Jojo needs to be reassured of our normal human responses to insecurity, to fear, etc. And he fulfills that until Jojo starts to question, through his relationship to Elsa, the Jewish girl living in the attic, through that relationship he starts to question the things that he's had camaraderie with this extension of himself around. And that's where you see the imaginal character of Hitler start to kind of fight back
mm-hmm.
and become who Hitler was.
Right. Kind of loses his grip on Jojo.
Yep.
Jojo does go through something that changes him. He no longer qualifies to
right.
be a part of the war, the nationalist mm-hmm. project
mm-hmm. right.
in the same way, and is relegated to the sidelines, putting up Nazi propaganda and wandering around in his little uniform. You know, one thing I thought was interesting is the way that the uniform is so important to him, and that could be true for any of us who've ever dressed up as Peter Pan or Batman or whatever, that somehow there's such a joy in dressing up in a uniform of some kind or a costume of some kind. And his sensibility about what's really going on only is channeled through these completely whacked out propaganda about what Jewish people are like. So by the mm-hmm. the point that he ends up discovering Elsa in the attic, their engaging becomes very toying but important. It is the point at which he gets to transform.
Well, because what she does with him that I think is different than what he's experienced with the other young people that he's involved with who are members of the Hitler Youth is she teases him. But it's the kind of teasing that is also accompanied by a kind of care. It's the kind of teasing that invites you closer. It doesn't alienate. It asks you questions. It seems to me her teasing, asking of him something that allows him to wonder, and it's offering him keys to the things that he's afraid of, to his own insecurity. That is a deeply generous human act that she is able to extend to him.
Mm-hmm.
It's a game changer for him.
Because their first encounter is not so loving,
No. But
they come to an agreement that they will be each other's secret.
Right.
And that Precisely. Then plays off of this idea that he continues to have a kind of imaginary relationship with someone who's actually real.
Mm-hmm. She says, "We're just like you, except that we're human," which seems to indicate that there is something that she recognizes him to be in the process of losing as a human being. That is still intact somehow in her understanding of herself within the larger context of war mm-hmm. as somebody who can see so many facets, you know, that comes as a necessary response in a situation where one is trying to survive, that you can see as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And not only does she see that, but she sees that he is at risk of losing something.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And he's 10.
Yeah, he's a child.
Yeah. His capacity to do harm is there. We see that. He does it in this very childlike manner. Once he feels like he has feelings for Elsa, he begins to write these letters to her from her boyfriend, not realizing the kind of pain that that could exact on her. To be told by your boyfriend that he no longer loves you. His intent is to win her over for himself, but he actually has then the power to do quite a lot of harm.
She knows it's a ruse the whole time.
Yeah.
But it still hurts her.
Yeah.
Because he's doing it. It's like, how could you do this, you mean little kid?
Mm-hmm.
What's making you so mean? You're 10. Why?
We see that he has a loving mother.
Mm-hmm.
She is conceivably using him as a bit of a smokescreen to her own actions and resistance. But she's invested in him seeking joy and having a great imagination and love.
I think one reviewer put it sort of like she's put herself at risk and she's put him at risk. But rather than that being interpreted as some kind of act of gross neglect, it's an act of even reserving for him this deeply human act.
Mm-hmm.
Should he survive?
Mm-hmm.
Should he survive intact as a human being, this will be something he has to carry that will connect him to other people, because he could just as easily survive physically, mm-hmm, without that internal capacity to love and to connect and to relate intact.
Mm-hmm.
She's making sure he has that.
Mm-hmm. And we both feel like the film can't necessarily be distilled down to any one thing. Maybe more than anything, it's a coming-of-age story in a very imaginative way on the part of the director, who has proven himself to take those kinds of things on. I mean, this is a director who made What We Do in the Shadows. If people haven't seen that, they might want to check it out.
Yeah.
It's fanciful. It's ridiculous. It's deeply humorous. He's entrenched his career in that kind of work. And so it makes sense that then he moved forward to try to challenge or raise questions about white supremacy, or even just to plain old set out to mock it.
Mm-hmm.
It makes sense that he do that through the eyes of a child.
Mm-hmm. Hunt for the Wilder People is another one of his films. And in that movie, one of the nemesis predatory authority figures is on a bandwagon to subvert the delinquent spirit of Ricky Baker, who is a young kid who has been in the foster system. And Taika Waititi really takes it upon himself to show the supremacist violent arm of the state in her character, and slowly but surely he punches a huge hole in it to show how humanity is really pressed down by these structures that are conjured by the indoctrination of Western structures, how the state creates power out of insecurity in the character of that foster system probation officer, the insecurity that drives her supposed benevolence and creates in her a sense of supremacy, is this very important thing for Waititi to diffuse, to show the weakness in it. There have been reviewers who have claimed that this is a movie that gets lost in sort of a good German trope, the good side of the oppressor. Really, I think what he's doing is he's saying, you can punch a big hole in this. And you can see that inside of that is this incredibly problematic, developed insecurity that only has one way to kind of unroll itself, and that's in the expression of supremacy.
Right, the path to belonging.
The path to belonging.
Mm-hmm. He also uses very relatable imagery and music in the film. He doesn't stick to time frames. This is, I think, true of many of his films.
Or accents,
yeah. Humor is obviously both essential to the film and has caused a lot of the concern, and I would say there's a bit of uproar as well. But humor is this deeply important avenue or lifeline for Waititi in all of his films.
One of the critical responses is based in the assumption that one is laughing at the tragedy of genocide during this particular historical context, the Holocaust. And really, that's not what's happening at all. The humor is used as a survival mechanism, a way to stay buoyant under extremely difficult and challenging circumstances. Humor allows the imagination to stay intact and to see oneself at the end of the day not as simply the sum of what's been done to you. It's a way to shake that off. At the end of the day, that's not all of who I am. I'm more than a victim, you know? Mm-hmm. I'm somebody who still has all of these experiences. Mm-hmm. And will do everything I can to continue to have joy, to continue to have a full range of emotions and psychological responses, deep responses to my life. I will not just be diminished that way. And laughter, rebellious humor are wonderful tools that humans have, who have experienced these kinds of atrocities, have held on to, mm-hmm. you know, to kind of push back that violence.
Naomi, thanks for sitting in on this one. We're going to make sure that you come back to the Old Mole real soon.
Okay.
We'll give you a chance to recover, and then we'll have you on back. But we definitely think this film is very much worth seeing, and it's relatable in our times. It's relevant to our existence, really in a state of perpetual conflict on all levels, from schools to war, imperialism, all of it. We're stuck in this cycle of conflict, and I think that state can only really continue until we can collectively challenge everything that we know, everything we think we know about who we are.
Well, and I think in closing, I would add to that that what Taika Waititi also offers us is, as my friend Denise here has put it before, is some recovery time. You know, in the big picture, like the humor and the laughter as a response to getting into really difficult subject matter is a real gift to all of us. And I would also encourage people to check out his other work, Eagle versus Shark, Boy, Hunt for the Wilder People, What We Do in the Shadows, and just really enjoy and appreciate this individual, Taika Waititi's creative expression, his gift that he offers all of us.
Absolutely. Well said. This has been Denise Morris and Naomi Kanori reviewing Jojo Rabbit.
Thank you.
And you are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Well, to wrap up today's show, our Left in the Law duo, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker, are going to be surveying the good and the bad of legal posts made during this last year, both the Trump administration's federal appointments, but also the different campaigns to elect progressive prosecutors. To lead off, here's a clip from the old radio drama, Mr. District Attorney.
Mr. District Attorney. Champion of the people. Defender of truth. Guardian of our fundamental rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
And it shall be my duty as district attorney not only to prosecute to the limit of the law all persons accused of crimes perpetrated within this county, but to defend with equal vigor the rights and privileges of all its citizens.
Well, this is Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker talking today about the state of the law in the Trump era, the good news and the bad news, the whether the true heroes are the ones of yesteryear that we heard about in that bit. So, Mike, should we start with the good news or the bad news?
Let's start with the bad news.
Okay, and dispense with that as quickly as possible.
Yes, the bad news is that the Federalist Society held a dinner at which 3,000 people came to celebrate new Justice Kavanaugh and the fact that 150 judges have now been appointed by the Trump administration on federal benches all over the country.
But there may have been some cooks in that kitchen putting nasty stuff into their food, because these same people are not very popular, including Kavanaugh. People apparently practically spit on him when he walks through public spaces these days. But tell us what the Federalist Society is, for those of us who've forgotten, repressed the Kavanaugh hearings.
It's a marginal, very conservative legal group that used to be just a small gathering of like a few disgruntled friends of Justice Rehnquist. But now they call the shots. They chart the course.
They come up with these lists.
Trump has basically turned over the process of picking federal judges to them.
So how many does 150 represent in the
a lot.
a lot out of the larger body of federal judges?
It's like one out of six, maybe. It's it's a substantial number, and they're spread all over the country. They've transformed the Ninth Circuit, which used to be liberal. Now it's more conservative than not. It's true for several other parts of the country. It's a sea change. I mean, and the Christians and the evangelicals are thrilled by this, because even
though conservative Christians, just to be fair.
Well, absolutely. Well, it's those who, for example, have targeted abortion, have tolerated all sorts of Trump shenanigans that they don't care for in order for this payday. They are quite likely to succeed in getting abortion held to be not something required by the Constitution. They've got their own justices from the highest to the lowest levels of federal court.
So let's turn to the good news. There's a movement of progressive prosecutors entering the stage, a fight back on that level. Let's first talk about what prosecutors do who are elected, and
well, prosecutors,
where they are in the whole criminal justice system versus the judges.
Well, if you had to have one branch and only one branch of the government, it would, I think, for crime as well as several others, you'd want the executive branch, because prosecutors determine what cases judges hear.
And when you say the executive branch, you mean control. Can you say more what you mean by that?
I mean the prosecutors. They are the ones charged with executing the laws, of carrying them out.
They're kind of the executive branch of the criminal justice system?
Yes. And they are the ones who determine whether in any particular act will be charged as a crime, and if so, what kind of crime. And they have immense power. They can and do, for example, routinely overcharge people in order to compel a guilty plea. They will charge, if there's a melee, for example, between the police and 10 or 12 people, either in a jail or in a demonstration, and some of the people are hurt a little bit and other people are hurt a lot, you can be sure, it's almost a mathematical law, that those who have been hurt the most will be charged with the most serious crimes.
But don't the police also have a lot of latitude and discretion in who they charge and book and how laws are administered on the streets or applied on the streets?
Well, of course they do on the street, but they don't have any responsibility over who gets charged. They can ask prosecutors to do or not do, but they finally have to defer to the prosecution. So there have been stunning changes on that front. And by stunning, I mean large scale. The first was probably Larry Krasner in Philadelphia, which was a center of right-wing activities from back to the days of Mayor Frank Rizzo, and tremendous numbers of death penalty cases came out of Philadelphia.
The bombing of MOVE, that right. Organization, yeah.
Well, he stopped all that and has even appealed to get rid of the death penalty. And the death penalty has around the country now precipitously dropped, largely because of the replacement of death penalty-oriented prosecutors by people like Krasner. And I mean, now it's not simply Larry Krasner, who's an engaging, articulate, very forceful guy, but in Northern Virginia, in San Francisco, in Boston, in Houston, in Orlando, all over the place, in Chicago. Kim Fox in Chicago has caught some grief for not prosecuting Jesse Smollett. But basically, she's had a tremendous effect in lowering the numbers of people charged with felonies. Thousands of cases have not been brought as felonies, which mean that people are not going to be locked in jail without an ability to pay and get out. They won't lose their jobs. They'll have all sorts of bad effects that would have happened previously that are simply not happening now.
It's also interesting that progressive DAs like Larry Krasner describes this as, quote, a movement and not a moment. And of course, this departs from the script of the heroic DA, the single champion of justice, defending the public against real and imagined enemies. How do you understand this as a movement?
I think it's a repercussion from all the publicity that police shooting of unarmed people and has taken all over the country. There are TV shows, there's regular reporting about this now. It used to happen below the surface, but now the killing of unarmed children of color is something that's very newsworthy and is created, I think, just as DNA made people skeptical about the accuracy of death penalty convictions. All this publicity now about police shootings and has had a deeper effect. And the tremendous amount of people who've been enmeshed in the criminal justice system, all their relatives now, they have hooked up with other parts of progressive politics, and now it's become a central issue. So what would a successful prosecutor do? He would test every rape kit, for example. You could stand up to Trump on immigration, not cooperate with ICE, eliminate cash bail. It allows...
Can you say why, what it is about cash bail?
Well, cash bail allows any dangerous person or anybody with money to buy their way out of jail, but poor people can be faced with serious charges and have to pay several thousand dollars to get out of bail.
And those compound over time, right?
They compound over time, and so what people eventually do is plead guilty simply in order to be released, because a backed-up criminal justice system means they will languish in jail even without having been convicted of anything. So...
And these are kind of the behind-the-scenes parts of what's called the criminalization of poverty that get less attention than a dramatic encounter on the streets where an officer kills an unarmed black person, which, of course, is outrageous. But this is this low-level, systematic oppression that grinds people down in ways that are less apt to catch the media's eye.
That's exactly right. If you truly want to end mass incarceration, you have to do it by having prosecutors decide these are not worthy of being enmeshed in the whole felony charge system, that I'm not either not going to charge this person at all, or we're going to figure out a way of having some sort of civil penalty or some sort of restitution, some sort of restorative justice, or let it slide. There's lots of ways of dealing with an incident that surfaces. The kind of run-of-the-mill crimes where, like, your kid and his friends go over and decide to break into the house of one of their parents, and somebody carves their name on a table. Now, that goes to the cops, and what is the prosecution going to do with that? They could be charged from anything from a felony with years in prison to something where people will simply be diverted, and they'll have to, like, be nice formally for 6 months and do some community service, and then that's that. It's the prosecutor who makes these calls.
So let's continue following this... progressive movement that looks like it is more than a moment, and as we continue with our Left and the Law segments, and then perhaps turning to some of the resistance this same movement is facing with the police unions and other powerful actors in the criminal justice system. This is Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker talking today about the good news and the bad news of the law in the Trump era and the progressive prosecutor movement.
Well, thanks, Jan and Mike. That is all the time we have for today's Old Mole Variety Hour. I'd like to thank our other guests, Anthemis, who came on to talk with me about the rally on November 29th, Black Friday, in Pioneer Square from noon to 3 to demand fair enforcement justice and an abolition to fares. Don't forget to listen to Labor Radio tonight. My Well Read Red this morning was promoting the two guests that are going to be on tonight talking about a lot of the same issues. Gabriella from Opal and Andrew Riley from the former ATU union representative are going to be talking about Opal's campaign to abolish fares, but also Andrew's inside perspective on really how TriMet could afford to make such a move. Thanks to Denise Morris and her guest Naomi Nori for discussing the very interesting dark comedy Jojo Rabbit. You can listen to The Old Mole and any of these segments in a day or two by going to kboo.fm/oldmole. If you'd like to become a member of KBOO, it is a member-supported station. It's how we make all of this amazing content. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate today. I'm your host for The Old Mole Variety Hour. Tune in next week, 9 to 10, for news, views, and radical interviews from our underground perspective.